Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
You know, Julie, I was thinking about hobos earlier.
Of course you are.
And of course, the great thing about hobos, as we think of the classic, Great Depression era wanderer with his bindle stick and his
handkerchief.
And his weird codes. And, it's like they would ride the rails. They would get from point A to point B by an accepted highway that existed between those, which was typically the rails.
Right.
Right. So, for the hobo, he's not really having to expend, he's kind of a lazy individual, or at least he has found value in other aspects of life that don't revolve around rigorous labor.
That's right.
So he will ride the rails and let the rails do all the work for him.
As he plays cards.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
So I was thinking, like, what if a hobo, a galactic hobo, as it were, needed to get from here to Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star to our own.
You do realize that we are equating astronauts with hobos.
Yes.
And that's perfectly fine.
Yes.
Yes. I just want to state that. That's spot on.
Right. I wish I had the internet here. I would do a search and see who was the first hobo astronaut, if we've had one. And if we haven't, we need to see about fulfilling that, if there are any hobos left.
Right.
Yeah. So Proxima Centauri, like I say, closest star to our own, which means it's an insane distance away. To put that in a little scale, it is 271,000 astronomical units, or AUs, away.
Wow.
All right. Now, don't let that number throw anybody off. 271,000 AUs.
I'm there with you.
Okay. One AU, a single astronomical unit, is the distance between Earth and the Sun. Okay? So it's that distance laid out 271,000 times. All right? So let's put all that in even another frame of reference here, okay? All right, this is a classic analogy, and I got this off of a NASA website. If the sun were the size of a typical half-inch diameter marble, okay, the distance from the sun to the Earth, again, an astronomical unit, would be about 4 feet. The Earth would be barely thicker than a sheet of paper, and the orbit of the moon would be about 1/4 an inch in diameter. And on this scale, the closest star, Proxima Centauri, would be about 210 miles away. So that's about the distance between Cleveland and Cincinnati.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're talking a massive distance here.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are no trains traversing that distance. So how would one get to that destination?
Wow. I mean, you pose a pretty lofty question there. I mean, we're talking about 25 trillion miles away.
Right.
Okay, so it's definitely not going to be a day trip.
Right, not a day trip.
Okay. What's the farthest we've ever gone?
Well, the Voyager probe
well, that's
have reached the farthest distance a man-made object has gone. So we're talking a colossal journey.
Okay.
Pretty much, for all intents and purposes, kind of an impossible one at this point. I mean, we could do it, but we'd have to have a phenomenal amount of will and
energy.
Yeah, and we'd have to maybe not be so into the idea of the hobo still being alive when you reach Proxima Centauri.
Right, right. So it comes down to energy, right?
Right. And it comes down to what's already making that trip. And I think, as the title of the podcast should spoil, light is the railway that one might traverse.
That's right.
Yeah.
Those wily little photons.
Yes. So, the idea of using a solar sail, and it's a pretty basic concept. It's exactly how you might think of it. You know, it's like you put up a sail on a ship,
mm-hmm.
and you catch the breeze, and you ride the wind across a lake, say. Well, the solar sail concept is pretty much the same thing. There's like a breeze of light. You put up the sail, it'll catch the breeze and push the sail.
I mean, at first glance, it really does seem kind of whimsical, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it sounds like it's a delightful, it sounds like something from some sort of like French animated film, something out of Fantastic Planet. And indeed, you do see these designs show up like unrealistically in things from time to time. Like I think there's one in Tron, and I think that second, Star Wars prequel has some sort of a solar sail thing.
Yeah.
So it's easy to sort of dismiss it as just as being like sailing ships in outer space kind of a deal. But the idea's been around for a while. The astronomer Johannes Kepler, who we recently talked about in another podcast.
That's right.
He actually is perhaps the earliest to come up with the concept, back in the 16th century. and he noticed that comet tails always point away from the sun, implying that sunlight itself is pushing them around like cosmic windsocks, right?
Right.
So he thought that you could just simply get like a ship with a sail, and you know, if it was properly put together, you could sail around out there, which sounds kind of fantastic, but it was really on the right track.
Okay, so his hunch was right.
Yeah.
I do have to point out that he also thought that comets were formed of fatty globules in ether. So
well,
he's one for two.
Well, you can't get everything right, okay?
I know.
You're really asking
right.
A lot.
A lot of limitations back then, too.
But just to run down exactly how this is working. All right, scientists now know, with the advent of all the things we've learned since the 16th century, that sunlight is a little more than a stream of photons, tiny particles of light. And they don't possess mass, but they do boast linear momentum.
Right, and they're the smallest quantum of light, right?
Okay. Yeah. And when they bounce off of a reflective surface, they push against that surface. There's actually a push. So just, just look at anything. Like I'm looking right now at a lamp and a canister of tissue paper. You know, granted that the tissue paper is not crawling across the desk pushed by the light.
No, it's
but
not.
But even though it's not visible to the naked eye, there is a certain amount of momentum to that light.
Yeah. And if that tissue box were super light and it was reflective, mm-hmm. then we'd see more momentum, right?
Right. And if it were in outer, free of the confines of Earth's gravity, then we start, opening up the rules a little bit.
Right.
So, after Kepler was long dead, 1873, you had James Clerk Maxwell, and he first demonstrated that sunlight exerts a small amount of pressure on photons. In 1960, we launched a little something called Echo 1, and observed the sun pushing it around. Echo 1 and I believe Echo 2 were both pretty awesome because they were basically super balloons. They mm-hmm. They rose up to an altitude of 1,000 miles. And, were actually space balloons in a very real sense of the word. And they look kind of like they're huge spheres. They kind mm-hmm. of look like giant Christmas tree ornaments.
Okay.
Just a very thin, layer of reflective surface with a gas inside.
Yeah, I can't help but think of hot air balloons without the bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this case, they observed the sun actually pushing on it.
So the basics behind that then is that you've got a reflective surface.
Mm-hmm.
You've got light.
Right.
And like you said,
not just reflective, but highly reflective.
Highly
surface,
reflective.
Yeah. Like a sheet of metal or a plastic coated with metal.
Okay.
And then it's reflecting the light.
Okay. Yeah. And so the sails that we have right now, they're thin sheets of metal, like you said, and they've got the plastic substrate in between. And then, the reflective film faces the sun.
Right.
Is that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And it seems really whimsical to think that this might be something that could power us to Alpha Centauri.
Yeah. It sounds far-fetched, but actually, the more you look at it, the more realistic it is. We've actually, I talked about this subject with Dr. Gregory L. Matloff, who you can look him up online. He's a pretty brilliant dude and just can talk about solar sails at the drop of a hat mm-hmm. and just tell you all about them. So the things that I get right in this podcast, I attribute to him, and the any errors I make are purely my own doing. Mariner 10 is an example of a probe that we sent out. It was not in and of itself a solar sail.
Right.
But it had solar cells on it. It had it was gaining some energy from the sun because it was on a mission around Mercury, right, where there's lots of solar energy due to the proximity of Mercury to the sun.
Okay.
So they were running low on gas to power its corrective boosters. So they were able to use its solar cells as an impromptu solar sail to maneuver it a little, and they had some success with that. And so since that point, we've had a number of other experiments. The U.S. especially had a habit of like putting a lot of work and thought into them, and then not doing anything with it.
Right. It was usually because the funding dried up.
Yeah, exactly. In the 70s, Dr. Lewis Friedman wanted to send a probe out to Halley's Comet, and they were going to use solar sails for the rendezvous, but that was scrapped. The Russian Space Agency had the whole spinning space mirror program, the Zhanmaya 1 and 2, and possibly 3. I'm not sure if 3 actually came to fruition, but the whole idea was they were going to reflect sunlight back to the Earth so mm-hmm. that they could give sunlight to some of the, you know, the far northern regions that were pretty short on it during the winter.
Right.
And at any rate, that was able to successfully demonstrate some of those properties of the solar sail, even though those projects were far from, you know, tremendously successful. And, just as a side note, they were apparently designed to the point where they could provide luminosity between 5 and 10 times a full moon. So, India's INSAT 2A and 3A communications satellites in 1992 and 2003, they were, there was like a 4-panel solar array on one side, and they were able to use some aspects of solar sail technology to maneuver it. And, of course, then the Japanese finally beat us to the punch on getting, you know, it's like we were just...
The years get up, right? We sort of see this as a trend that we're left a little bit in the dust.
They were able to launch this wonderful little device called Icaros. And it's, I say little, but it had, it's basically a huge square, some 20 meters in a diagonal line. And it's as thin as like 0.0075 millimeters, and it's made from a polyamide resin.
Right, it's called the space yacht, right? Just to give you an idea of how big it is.
Yeah, and the headlines really loved using that space yacht thing too. But it's pretty cool because it was like this central hub that would rotate, and then the sails would spread out on all sides around it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and they used a rocket to get it up there, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then it unfurled.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's been pretty successful so far. We're still keeping eyes on it to see how it's gonna do in the near future. But the spacecraft itself was launched May 20th, 2010, and with the whole idea that it was going to spend a 6-month trip traveling to Venus, and then it was going to be in a 3-year journey to the far side of the sun. So. It's the world's first solar-powered sailcraft employing both photon propulsion and thin-film solar power generation. So it's getting some energy from the sun for some of its thrust, but then it's also using solar sails.
Okay, and they're able to manipulate that.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But the really cool thing is, you know, no fuel. It's all based on the sun. Some
right.
of it's solar sails, some of it's solar cells to power these little thrusters, and. Then there's, of course, NASA's NanoSail D.
That's right.
Which is currently, as of this recording, NASA has lost contact with it. It was, recently launched just in the past month. And it's what's called a nanosatellite or a CubeSat. And it's merely designed, it's one of several different experiments that were launched. And it's up there just to test the potential for solar sails in atmospheric braking. And that's when you have an interplanetary vehicle and you send it, say, to Mars, and you want it to slow down when it gets to Mars.
Right. It was also ejected from another satellite, right? Which is kind of a cool way to get multiple satellites up there orbiting at the same time.
Yeah. It's like, let's get a satellite up there, load it with some nanosatellites, each one, like, testing some particular technology.
Yeah.
And so in this case, this one tested solar sails. But, so keep your fingers crossed. Right now, it's not looking too hot for it. But, I don't know, maybe it's just part of the curse with U.S. solar sail technology.
Break the curse, NanoSail D.
Okay, so it's worth wondering just how fast are these things going?
Right.
Because again, I'm looking at the Kleenex box; it's not moving. So it's just looking at that. It's hard
to you. It's not.
Yeah, it's not moving.
Yeah.
To me, but it's hard to look at that and then imagine the sun pushing these satellites or even a spaceship with a hobo inside it. Like how is that going to reach any amount of speed? But you'd actually be surprised. All right. If you were to reduce the mass of one of these devices significantly, you mm-hmm. could see it eventually traveling at about like 56 miles per second.
Okay.
Which is
crazy.
Yeah, like that's basically like 200,000 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's 10 times faster than the space shuttle's orbital speed of 5 miles per second, and it would be like traveling from New York to Los Angeles in less than a minute. If NASA were to launch an interstellar probe powered by solar sails, it would take only 8 years for it to catch Voyager 1 spacecraft, which has been traveling for 20 years and is the most distant spacecraft from Earth, like we mentioned earlier. So the speed can really pick up. And the key with it, with any kind of interstellar voyage, because it's you want to start as close to the sun as possible.
Okay.
It's kind of like imagine that you have a fan in a room, like an electric fan and a paper airplane. And you want to use the power of that fan to sail that paper airplane across this big room. you want to start it as close to that fan as possible to get the biggest immediate push.
Yeah, to get the most momentum. And so is the idea, too, that the greater the distance, the greater the velocity?
Yes.
It's going to go a lot faster?
Yeah, and you want to have as light of materials as possible,
right.
You know, as reflective as possible. So, you know, I was talking to Matt Loff, and he said, yeah, if you had using, you know, sort of current technology, you would you'd get this thing close to the sun as possible, probably within the orbit of Mercury, and get it in position, and then you unfurl those sails, right? And then all that reflection starts taking place.
Right.
And it could probably reach 200 astronomical units in something like 15 years, 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
That kind of field. So if you were putting a hobo on that, I don't know how, forget about how much a hobo weighs. Let's just, you know, for, just to jazz it up, we'll say a hobo's aboard, even if it's like a nano hobo.
Right.
Yeah. And, and you were going to launch
it. Be present in the future, by
yes,
the way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it's coming. They're going to be made out of nanotubes.
Yeah.
You were going to launch him from Mercury, towards Proxima Centauri. It would probably take 7,000 years for him to reach it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So, again, that sounds really, really slow. It is a colossal distance.
I mean, at that point, you'd need a generation ship, right? So that
right.
the hobo could make other little hobos that in
yeah.
8,000 years.
Or your hobo has to be purely mechanical or even a program.
Yeah.
Like, one of the really cool things about nanotechnology is when you start looking at the possibilities of deep space probes, they don't have to be as big as a room, right? As the technology improves, we can see that we make smaller and smaller probes capable of going out there and relaying a message or even, you know, carrying sensory equipment.
Right. Again, how carbon nanotubes are changing our life.
Exactly. And in fact, that was one thing Matt Loft touched on too. It's like if this improves and we're able to make, say, a 50 nanometer, thick sail, if you built it in space, you know, and you could probably, make an interstellar voyage in as little as 2,000 years. And go, so the lighter you go, and you could go even faster. And one possibility too would be to have like holes in your sail, if it perforated, because you'd still, you know, cover a huge space, still reflective, but taking up less mass.
Okay.
So it's just a game of like cutting down how much space they take.
How small can you get?
Yeah.
In order to go as
yeah.
fast as you can.
Yeah. And just, you know, huge sails as well.
Right. Well, yes, I guess small meaning weight.
Yeah. And so, Matt Loft also, said that, you know, as we get into these carbon nanotubes and graphenes and all these type of futuristic materials, he thinks we'll do a lot better than 2,000 years. He thinks we may even get, you know, below 1,000 years. And he says he has his doubts when we get into talking about like a couple of hundred years. So it would still take
with our current technology.
No. This would be with forthcoming nanotechnology.
Okay.
We would and this is just talking about, you know, getting into the orbit of Mercury.
Okay.
And slingshotting it out on that beam of light.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, but we're using some current technology to sort of.
Yeah, current technology, you're looking at a 7,000 year trip.
All right.
But with conceivable, more or less near future technology, you could get it down to 1,000 years, maybe a number of centuries.
Okay, so some of the technology we have right now, it's just a matter of decreasing it
right.
to the size that we need it to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's go back to the...
I had to get that right in my head.
Yeah. So let's get back to that paper airplane in the room with the electric fan. Let's say you're shooting it off and it's not making it all the way. What's one thing you can do to increase the chances of delivering that paper airplane to the far side of the room?
I can harness it with nuclear arm heads.
No. No, but what you can do is say you got a different fan.
Yeah.
A more powerful fan, right?
Yeah.
So we can't really replace the sun, right?
Right.
I mean, not with any kind of conceivable technology. If we could reach the point where we could replace the sun, we wouldn't be trying to figure out how to travel to the far side of the galaxy.
Exactly.
Because we'd probably be doing it every day. So, but one thing we can do is we can concentrate those particles, by use of a laser or a particle accelerator.
Okay.
Because these are basically just concentrated photons.
Right. Okay, so we know the photons have momentum, so if we did have giant lasers, then you would have so much more energy to concentrate. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay.
You could have a solar-pumped laser, which is basically a laser that's feeding off solar energy that's absorbed.
Okay.
So the idea here is if you got one of these just crazy advanced lasers, you could point it in the direction that you want to solar sail.
Okay.
You know, kind of like laying a train track. Point it in the direction of, say, Proxima Centauri. And then you just, you coast that solar sail craft into the stream, and then whammo, it just takes off. It's like grabbing hold of, being on a skateboard and grabbing hold of a passing vehicle.
Okay.
And suddenly you're off at
it. So you have a couple things at work. You've got the added acceleration of the beam, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the fact that the greater the distance you travel, the faster you're going. So two of those forces working on it?
Yeah, provided you built a large enough laser, a large enough sail, and a light enough spacecraft, and, had a light enough hobo in it, you could conceivably, according to Matlof, according to his estimations, with this higher velocity, you could conceivably deliver that ship to the nearest star, to Proxima Centauri, within a human lifetime.
Whoa. Okay, so that's how we get to see it in this lifetime.
Well,
not this lifetime.
But within the space of a single lifetime.
That's how our forebears will.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So yes, future generations of hobo could conceivably do this.
Right.
Now you get into questions of energy costs for that laser, right? Because I think some of the estimates are looking at all the power generated on the Earth would have to go into that laser.
And then some, right?
Yeah, and then some.
Yeah, so... There you go. That's a bit of a logistics problem.
Not to mention you're pointing a laser at a distant point in the galaxy. You've got to sort of think, what if there's somebody over there? And they're like, whoa, they're firing a laser at us. And then are they going to overreact and fire a laser back at us?
Yeah.
We think we're just laying some train track, but we're actually firing the first shot in Earth's first and last galactic war. That would kind of suck.
That would suck.
Now, another cool idea is to send off a slow-moving vessel and use lasers as a form of transport between us and that vessel.
Okay, explain more.
Okay, so again, it's you send off a slow-moving, maybe unmanned vessel.
Okay.
All right, just powered by more conventional systems, kind of like these generation ships you hear talk about in sci-fi and cosmology, where it's traveling such a vast distance that you would have generations live and die aboard it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, instead of that, you sort of keep it tethered by this laser. Or maybe you don't have the laser fired up at all times, but whenever you need to, you know where it is, you know where you are, you were able to fire up the laser and use solar sail technology to travel between the two.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's another possible use for some of this. But going back to just sort of non-laser solar sail technology, there are a number of cool possibilities here involving, say, using the solar sail to send cargo ahead of, say, a trip to Mars.
Right.
There have been some cool studies into how we could use it to mitigate a near-Earth object that's getting a little too close to our planet.
Okay, so if there was an asteroid coming at us?
Yeah, then we could, plans involve, actually putting a solar sail on it,
mm-hmm.
and then it catches the light and it steers it away, nudges it out of the way.
Okay.
And then there's some where there's a satellite beaming, putting a beam of light on the asteroid and kind of pushing it with light.
Yeah.
And then there are also plans where you just, splash it with white paint.
And it self reflects and then moves, right? So, and I thought that was interesting because I was reading a little bit about it and said something about how it would be really hard to sort of tether an asteroid because it's rotating, it's maybe tumbling, so you'd really have to get a system of gimbals to anchor it, get your solar sail anchored to the surface of it.
But we have successfully landed vessels, before, so it's not, completely crazy, but still.
It's better than the nuclear option, right?
Yes,
of shooting
definitely.
Down an asteroid.
And turning it into a giant shotgun blast still headed for the Earth.
Right.
And then another really cool thing, like we talked about with Icarus, it doesn't need fuel. It has, it's all sunlight. So this is a tremendous opportunity for instance, there's some plans to, put out some sort of a probe to keep an eye on solar flare. So we'll have advanced warning of dangerous radiation levels headed to the Earth. You put a more of a traditional satellite out there in a high solar area. You're going to need fuel so that it can correct itself with its thrusters to maintain its position. But if you could have all of that solar based, then there's no need to worry about how much fuel it has. It's just for all intents and purposes, it's self-sufficient.
Okay. So, I mean, it sounds to me like it's just a, in the very short term, it's an easy way to collect more data.
Yeah.
In a more efficient way.
Yeah. It's basically just really, the thing that really amazes me about it is that it's just kind of like a really common sense idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's common sense of the idea is, needless to say, is, you know, we need to work out the engineering to make it to work, to really perfect it.
Right.
You know, and we need to not lose contact with the satellites that are testing it. But still, you talk to guys like Matt Loff and other experts, and they really believe in this technology, and they really see it as playing a role in our cosmic future. So,
yeah, and I think a lot of people will say, well, that's crazy to, you know, why would you spend the energy and the money to create this technology to go to Alpha Centauri,
mm-hmm.
or Proxima Centauri, whichever you prefer. But I mean, if you think about it, that purportedly would have planets, Alpha Centauri, that would be Earth-like. At least that's what we think. And so if we ever had the...
Or at least other systems. I'm not so sure. I'm not sure what the outlook is on...
I think that the suspicion is that they might have sort of like rocky planets like Earth. And so the suspicion is, okay, let's go out there and have this opportunity to observe planets if we could, and the suns if we could, and take that data back home and even use it to get a better understanding of our own planet. I think that sometimes people think there's too much of a disconnect between space and Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that's, if you never tried to find out anything about space, it would be like never leaving your house your entire life.
Yeah.
Being born inside this one house and dying inside this one house. And you would never have a full understanding of your life if you didn't have other things to compare it to and to get a perspective on.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's so fascinating that this technology exists right now and how far it can get us in the future.
Yeah, and just in terms of practicality too, when it comes to deflecting potentially dangerous, potentially like extinction level near Earth asteroids.
Yeah.
Like we've never done that before. We've never had to do it. But should we ever do that, that'll be the one time in human history that humans have ever done anything to save the planet. In a very literal sense.
Right.
Like, you watch big, dumb summer action films, it's like people save the world every week, you know? Every comic book hero that's ever existed has saved the world at least once.
Right.
But in reality, we've never done that. This is the one realistic chance we ever have at saving the planet. I mean, aside from the things that we, you know, can do to keep ourselves from destroying it.
That's right. And we can't rely on Bruce Willis to save
no,
the planet.
No, he's got gigs that he's doing at bars.
That's
He just can't expect to get him at the job of a hat. So, hey, we have some listener mail.
Let's bring it.
Let's do it. I have one here. Both of these relate to our recent podcast about music rebuilding the mind.
Yeah.
Where we talk about the connection between music and our brains and what's going on when we listen to music or you know, partake of any kind of musical exercise. We've received a lot back from people on that, and especially when it comes to earworms. So Justin writes us, and he says... hey guys, I just discovered your podcast a couple of days ago, and your literal blow the mind episode about people's heads blowing up was fantastic. Since then, I've listened to almost a dozen more, and I just listened to your podcast on music in the mind. As far as non-lyrical earworms, none of mine focus on what is being said. However, what is strange is the tone of the vocals is what gets stuck in my head. Example, Rush's Closer to the Heart.
Yeah.
You know this one?
Yeah.
How's it go?
I can't say like the words, but I can do the tongue.
Okay.
That wasn't it.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
So there we just got him again. If you were listening there, Justin. He says when the song floats back, it is never the actual content, but instead the sounds of the vocal. Exactly. Like you couldn't remember the words offhand.
Yeah.
You could remember the
and this is no slight to Rush, but I kind of feel like I could use that example for every single one of their songs. Just that one little melody there.
And then Justin also added, P.S., I did a neat undergrad collateral study on the predicators of crime and found that a state's power energy usage and how each state voted, Republican or Democrat, were correlated to crime amongst other things. So he recommends we look into that for a possible future episode.
That sounds pretty cool.
And then I have another email here, and this one's pretty cool too. This is from a listener by the name of Gabriel. And Gabriel got a big kick out of the term auditory cheesecake and thought it sounded delicious. But he also pointed out, quote, by the way, if there's an earworm that's bugging you, there's a little site called www.unhearit, that's UNHEARIT.com. That will replace a song that's been peanut buttered on your brain by peanut buttering another song onto your cranium. Give that a try next time Poker Face rears its ugly head. And I actually checked this out, and it seems to work. It's kind of dangerous. It's kind of like playing Russian roulette with sometimes bad songs. Like I just, you know, you can click through it, and each time it'll bring up a SoundCloud file with a particular song. And I did not have an earworm earlier today when I checked it out, but it did get some sort of like, I don't even know what it was, but some sort of little electronic tune was momentarily caught in my head. But you could conceivably replace Poker Face with, whoop, there it is, if you're not careful.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a dicey prospect, because right now I have got my seasonal earworm going on, which is simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
Oh.
Thanks a lot, Paul McCartney. So, yeah, I'd have to kind of go there and see if it was... I can't imagine a worse earworm, though, than Paul McCartney's simply having a wonderful Christmas time. So I guess the bets are pretty good in my favor.
Thinking of Whoop, There It Is, it does remind me, and I'm not trying to make light of mental illness here, but I once went to a local grocery store, and it was at night, and it was one of these grocery stores that's, you know, it's a big grocery store, and it's kind of like everybody goes there. It's like you'll see hipsters there, you'll see, but you also see people that are down on their luck. And this one particular gentleman who was, I think, a little down on his luck, seemed to only be able to speak the words "Whoop, There It Is," like he was just constantly saying "Whoop, There It Is."
Wow!
And then when people would, like, a guy came up to, you know, ask him something, you know, before he entered the store, he was like responding like in a conversational tone, but the only words coming out were "Whoop, There It Is."
Oh, okay. I thought at first that you meant that he was sort of like capping his thoughts with "Whoop, There It Is."
No. Like that was the only words he was saying. Like he was just kind of walking, going "Whoop, There It Is," "Whoop, There It Is," and then like somebody talks to him and he's like "Whoop, There It Is," "Whoop, There It Is." Like that was the only way he could converse.
Different inflections.
Yeah, different inflections. So
that's fascinating.
It was really fascinating.
Whoop, and There It Is.
It's like, is this like the terminal? This is what happens if you cannot get an earworm out of your head.
Yeah.
Probably not. There's probably a lot of other stuff going on there, but it was so weird that this was the one song that ended up being his, you know, all that he was.
It's too bad you couldn't have introduced him to the other.
Yeah,
site.
Yeah. If he found about that website, it could have saved him a lot of hassle.
Gosh.
And speaking of websites, you can check us out on two particular websites, that being Facebook or Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those. And also, we do have an excellent article on the main site about solar sails, how solar sails work. So just drop that into the search bar, and you'll find it's really good oversight of just how all this works. So if anything that I told you kind of threw you, then go there, and it should clear any questions up.
Yeah, and if you have any questions or comments about hobos and solar sails, drop us a line at belowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.